George Washington's birthday, February the 22nd, Wednesday, was an offbeat day for me spent in New York. I caught the 9 o'clock shuttle and arrived at the Carlisle at 10:15. Jack Valenti had been aboard. We drove him in. He and Mary Margaret are leaving next Sunday for Spain. I keep on finding such delicious examples of what other people do in their lines of work. First, there was Miss Trez and Adele Simpson, and then the marquee close. Linda Bird was sleeping very late. Thank goodness I remembered it was a holiday. She'd been out with John Loeb Jr. the night before, and when she finally woke up was full of gay chatter. Molly Parnas came in time for lunch, and Sally Victor. We had fittings of her things, and I made a few more tentative choices. I could tell, being very parsimonious according to Bessie's way of thinking. She and Helen both look at me with a mild reproval and assure me that I will indeed need everything I'm getting, and several more in addition that I say I cannot afford. Molly sometimes tells interesting little anecdotes of her days with helping Mrs. Eisenhower, and I'm always reassured and pleased that none of them would I mind being told if I were Mrs. Eisenhower. She does not, however, say anything about Mrs. Kennedy, although I think I've read that Mrs. Kennedy got some clothes from her, and I do not ask. We lunched in front of the big picture window giving out onto the park, an unforgettably thrilling view. I have all these scenes locked in my heart. Remember when life is quieter. How funny that just trying on clothes should be so tiring. By the time Mr. Stavropoulos came, and he was loudly announced from the foot of the steps by one of the Secret Service men, much to Bess's chagrin and mine, because Molly Parnas and Sally Victor were just leaving. By this time, I found that I was really tired, and quite sure I only wanted one dress from him, the exquisite yellow chiffon that looks like a Botticelli girl dancing in the dell, scattered with little daisies down the front. So it was a very pleasant, self-indulgent feeling to lie down and have a facial and read. Linda had left by this time, going out for lunch and a matinee, Black Magic, with John Loeb Jr., a very impressive young man. Actually, he's 36. Handsome, extremely New York. A totally different world from me, from Linda. When Linda came in, we went over the guest list that Mary's secretary had thoughtfully provided for us. Linda knows more of them and more about them than I do. I had my hair combed, piled on top of my head, and wore my pale yellow Adele Simpson dress with a jacket. And a little before 8, we left for Mary's. From the moment we entered, it was perfection. The flowers, the food, the setting, the guests. Everything in Mary's house is so exquisitely done. Living is an art, and planning and imagination and great taste have gone into making it so. There were about 30 guests for dinner. Memorable among them, the Marc Chagalls. He looks rather like an aging fawn, with his sprightly, very mobile face, his bushy eyebrows, and smile that lights up. He spoke only French, and a few halting words of English. But he said, rather charmingly, the face talks, his does. Everyone was talking about the sets he had done for the Magic Flute. Chagall loomed rather larger in the production than Mozart, and the James Hesters were there. He's the handsome head of New York University. He said yes, they were having their share, protesters and placard carriers. But nobody mentioned the 5-minute standing ovation that some government official got after there'd been a few dozen hecklers. He also said they were going to invite Lyndon to their June graduation ceremony. The distinguished and interesting Raymond Loewes were there, and I thanked him again for his help in giving design planning for items for the handicapped to make. He does it, I decided, for a very good reason. He's a naturalized citizen and still impressed with how wonderful it is to live in this country. He came from France and has been a citizen for 15 years. Quite without any opening for me, he got launched under the subject of anti-Americanism in France, which he assured me does not exist among young Frenchmen. They like our clothes, our dances, our cars, our way of living, he said. Mrs. Danny Kaye was there without her husband, who's doing the almost monastically hard work of taping a show. Handsome Hugh O'Brien slipped in a bit late and was sitting by Linda at dinner, and on her other side, a very attractive young doctor, Henry Betts, who is head of the Rehabilitation Institute in Chicago and looks scarcely over 20. I sat between Richard Rogers, the composer, and Linda's boss, Bob Stein of McCall's, whom I found very easy to talk to, and who seemed to take Linda pleasantly as a matter of course, and assured me that everybody at McCall's did too, though it certainly had posed problems at first. but he'd taken her around to meet every individual, so, he said, they wouldn't gawk at her in the halls. And aside from a few of the difficulties of traveling, the suite in San Francisco particularly, all had gone well. Most of the time, he said, she stayed in motels, was quite content to, and was unbothered. And here was I, great lover of the theater, sitting next to one of the biggest figures in it. Over how many decades? 3, 4? Richard Rogers, and I couldn't think of anything terribly bright to say to him. So I asked him which of his musicals had he really loved the most himself. He thought a minute and said Carousel. Fortunately, I did remember that that came from Lilium and was one of the very first things I ever saw when I was 15. Part of the seed that planted my long harvest of joy in the theater. I envied course after course. So delicious, so beautifully presented. There were two outstanding toasts, one rather offbeat by John Gunther. A toast to this room and all the interesting company it's housed over the many years he's known it, to the good talk here, to the beautiful paintings that line the wall, to the whole exquisite setting, very apt and bright. And then there was a toast by Linda that caught us all unawares. Because this is such an official occasion, she said, I want to propose a toast to the president. George, that is. It took several seconds before somebody began to laugh, and then everybody around the table followed suit as they realized it was George Washington. After all, this was his birthday. Then we dispersed into the other rooms, and gradually the after-dinner guests began to drift in. Leonard Lyons, whom I've been seeing for much more than 30 years, and who doesn't seem a bit older than the first time I saw him, and Molly Parnas, with her beautiful house guest, the Stanley Donans, he's a movie producer, and the John D. Rockefellers. I managed to have a few minutes with him. Talk about the wedding. It will be April the 1st. They're very happy. Mary had told me about the new method of smoke control that Major Alexander Dzhversky had invented, and when she brought him over to introduce him, I told him that I remembered his name well from the early 1950s when Lyndon and Stu Symington were so interested in increased air power. He's the very apostle of it, victory through air power. And he said, yes, I spent more than 50 years of my life working on airplanes, and now I'm a chimney sweep. Someone remarked with amusement that two of George Backer's wives were present, and friends were trying to keep them in different rooms. Lauren Bacall was one of the most charming women there. I looked at her and tried to analyze it. It's not looks. I think it's a full, lusty interest in life. There were lots of the beautiful young people, Kitty Carlisle and Marietta Tree and Susan Stein. And the most attractive man to me was John Loeb. I found it hard to talk to any individual. The room was so full. I danced a little, but was really more pleased when John Loeb said, come on, and took me to a quiet end of the room where we could look out on the river and the lights. And then we sat down for a few minutes with only 4 people. This was the happiest time of the evening for me. It was a star-studded group. Richard Kiley of The Man of La Mancha, the best show of the season, was there. David Merrick, dress designers, museum directors, investment bankers, a marvelous cross-section of a marvelous city, gathered together for me by the dearest friend, a sort of a feast, and so it was. The only person I was really disappointed in was me. And one I was particularly proud of was Linda, who was taking it all in like a sponge, bright, beautiful. Person after person came up to me, say, I didn't know how pretty she was, or she's grown into a new young woman this last year. A little before 1, I said goodnight to a few around the room, and dearest thanks to Mary, and goodbye to Linda. And a few vagrant flakes of snow were sifting down. When I was back in the Carlisle in bed, I could hear the wind roaring around that tower. I read until nearly 2 o'clock. A happy little postscript of the day had been in the New York Times about San Antonio winning the award as the cleanest town in the nation, a Nan Robertson story. It wasn't that so much as the fact that 50% more towns had entered the competition this year than last, and that after the decision had been reached and the award announced on the basis of a great big scrapbook full of pictures they had sent in, that the mayors and civic leaders from losing towns pored over the winning scrapbook like football coaches studying the films of the previous Saturday's disastrous game. Well, if it's making that sort of an impact, we're here to stay.